When I'm single, does my sexuality have any place in my relationship with another person? When I am engaged, does that change? Those are very difficult questions. What do I do with my sexuality if the answer is no, I shouldn't be using it? How do I deal with it? It is such a struggle.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKinsey Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
Jack, it seems like from the amount of times that you and I have talked about sexuality in these programs, and will continue to talk about sexuality, that we have a lot to say about sexuality. I was at a wedding this weekend, and one of the things that really struck me was how special the partners were to each other, or how we try and honor them in a marriage ceremony. They're the focus. The woman has on a very beautiful dress. Typically, the man is very dressed up. The focus is on those two. When they drink their cups together, they intertwine their arms, and we're watching them. When they have their cake together, they intertwine their arms, and we're watching them. We salute them in very many ways. What we need to do then is use that as a picture throughout our marriages, to say in very many ways that you are special to me, that you're important to me, that I am giving you my all, that I will do that for the very rest of my life. And that's really what our sexual intimacy is about. It's about saying that to our partner. You're special to me. You're important to me. I will give you my all. I will be most loyal to you in my life. I will cherish you. I will value you. I'm interested in you. You're important to me. That's what we have been saying that sexual intimacy is for. Given that, how can sexual intimacy be a part of somebody's life apart from being married? Is there any context where that is valid?
No.
Emphatically, no.
No. And that's the thing that we really need to see, is that I don't think the Bible could be clearer that the place for sexuality is between a man and woman who are married to one another and nowhere else, period. Now, I suppose we'll need to qualify that slightly, but the place to start is to realize, no, there's no place for it outside of marriage. And that's the second of the five things that I would list as the kind of the primary virtues of sexuality, is our of abstinence outside of marriage, our complete commitment to be non-sexual in my relationships with people when I'm not married to them. We talked about the ramifications of that for when I am married last week, that adultery is wrong. To go outside of my marriage for any kind of sexual encounter is just wrong. But what if I'm not married? Does it somehow make it okay to kind of explore my sexuality and experiment with it and have a little fun with it before I really get serious and committed in marriage? I think that's a very, very prevalent view in our society today. Many people who would abhor adultery don't have any problem at all with premarital sexuality. They view that as just sort of part of the stage of growing up where you experiment with your sexuality until you finally find the one that you want to marry, and then faithfulness is important. But until then, pretty much there's no limits, no boundaries on what you can do with your sexuality. That's wrong. Outside the context of a marriage relationship, it's inappropriate.
Okay, there's some people that would say, you know, there's really no boundaries. that I can experiment with it, and that's fine. Other people say, well, I really don't want to experiment with it, but how far can I go with being sexual outside of marriage before being married? I'm thinking about a conversation I had with a woman last week. She said to me, you know, I was a virgin when I got married. And I said to her very quickly, well, I was a virgin when I got married too. And then I kind of backtracked a little bit and I said, well, I was what I would call a Christian virgin. And what I meant by that is that I didn't have sexual intercourse before I got married, but I played with my sexuality. I did other sexual things and thought that was okay at the time, that I was really withholding a standard that I thought God had for me, not to have sexual intercourse. But in retrospect, I think I was really wrong. I know I was really wrong. I was playing with my sexuality. I was offering something to other men that really wasn't mine to give nor theirs to have.
Yeah, that's the critical thing to see. The same thing applies in the context of premarital sexuality that applies in the context of our discussion of adultery last time. How do we define sexual intimacy? Because what I would argue is that any sexual intimacy with someone that I'm not married to is wrong. So if I'm sexually intimate with someone while I'm not married and they're not married, then it's just as wrong as if I were in the context of a marriage being sexually intimate with someone not my spouse. It's still just as morally inappropriate, and for all the same reasons. It's because it's a lie. It's because I'm not committed to following through on what the promise of sexual intimacy entails. I'm not going to give them my life, so why am I promising my life with my body, with my sexual intimacy?
So, for example, I could kiss somebody erotically and longingly and for a long time and did and said that was a fine thing to do because I wasn't having sexual intercourse. Right. I would have said, what's wrong with that? That's just something that I'm enjoying and we're in a relationship with each other and it's part of our relationship together. And what you're saying is, let's draw the line, Willie, and what I say is, let's draw the line much further back, because my sexuality is a part of me, that it does have meaning. It does say, I'm committing myself to you. It is giving something of myself. It isn't just a simple act. It's something that is communicating that you're special to me, that I'm committing myself to you. And when I'm not really doing that, I'm lying to them.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same thing that we've said before. On the one hand, I'm lying to the person, and on the other hand, I'm trivializing the act in my own mind. I'm turning it into something casual when in fact it cannot be and is not casual. So I'm taking what God has created and trying to recreate it, trying to change it into something that it's not.
I'm redefining it,
and yeah. That's wrong. Years and years and years ago, it seems like ages ago, I read a book by a seminary professor. And the book at the time was entitled Sex for Christians. And it was just astounding to me, the thesis of his book. He argued that sexual I don't remember what he was defining. I think he was defining sexual intercourse. But he, for all practical purposes, he was defining what I would call sexual intimacy. He was defining sexual intimacy as the penetration of the vagina by the penis. That was sexual intimacy.
Period. Nothing
Period.
Else.
Period. Right. Therefore, what was it that the Bible was prohibiting, or what was the Bible proscribing? In other words, what was adultery and what was fornication? What was adultery and what was fornication is for penetration to occur in any other context other than the relationship between a husband and his wife. Therefore, any other erotic or sexual behavior that did not involve penetration was not immoral. That was the thesis of this book. And then he went on to have a whole chapter on what he called responsible petting. Remember, this was an old book. petting was the old-fashioned term for sexual foreplay of one kind or another. So basically what he was arguing is a responsible young Christian man and a responsible young Christian woman could responsibly engage in sexual foreplay together. And I think he meant you know, stimulation of one another's genitals, that sort of thing. That's what he meant by petting, I believe, and certainly kissing and fondling of variety of kinds. All of that could be engaged in responsibly by a young woman and a young man who are Christians seeking to be obedient to God without being immoral and without that being unrighteous and without that being ungodly, because the only thing that the Bible proscribes, the only thing that it prohibits, is penetration. You know, I didn't know as much at the time when I read that book, but even as ignorant as I was, my intuitive response was, this is crazy. This is absolutely absurd.
Now, my response at that time would have been, yippee, boy, I'm really holding the line, I'm doing it right, because this book even says, my intuition's out the window, I can just say that anything other than sexual intercourse is okay for me.
In fairness to the book, he said it's okay if it's done responsibly.
What did he mean by that?
Well, that's a good question. That was my question at the time. I mean, what can possibly be the difference between responsible and irresponsible extramarital petting? I don't know. It was a very bizarre concept, I thought.
Okay, so you were going to make a point that this man said that he defined sexual intimacy or wrong sexual intimacy as penetration. Anything else done responsibly is okay. What's your point?
Well, my point is that's really the a counterintuitive place to draw the line. All of us know, all of us desire what is erotic. All of us desire sexual stimulation. It's a natural desire that God has given us. God intends us to confront our desire for sexual stimulation responsibly, in a different sense in which he meant it. Responsibly meaning, don't pursue it, don't seek to have that desire fulfilled, except in the context of my relationship with my wife or husband. There and only there is the responsible context into which to pursue sexual stimulation of any kind whatsoever.
So to be responsible outside of marriage means not to pursue sexual arousal.
Exactly. Yeah.
At all.
Through any means or any method, exactly.
And not to communicate that I am committed to you by using my body in any way.
Right.
That is, even from an erotic handhold to a kiss to a glance to the way I dress to the way I talk. All of that needs to be non-sexual outside of marriage.
Right. Again, part of the commonsensical analysis of our experience that we have to confront is, who of us who have ever had an experience where, granted, we did not have intercourse, but we were involved in sexual arousal of one kind or another, and when that person eventually walked away from us, did not feel a sense of betrayal? Why a sense of betrayal? You know, I gave them myself. I gave them my body. I was committed to them. They rejected me. They walked away from me. Do we not feel humiliated when that happens? Do we not feel betrayed when that happens? Do we not feel the rejection of, they knew me and walked away? I mean, they didn't walk away from someone they didn't know. They walked away from someone that they knew because I let them know me. Aren't those the feelings that we have? Aren't those the way we react to that? And again, there's two ways we can analyze that. We can say, that's just a hang up. You know, that we need to get over that. We need to stop thinking about it that way. Or, why is it such a universal human experience? I would argue it's such a universal human experience because even that intimate sexual arousal that did not involve intercourse means the same thing as intercourse itself. It's all a part of it's all part of the same piece. It's all part of the same experience or encounter with the other person, of promising my life to the other person, of giving myself to the other person. That's the inherent meaningful significance of the act. And it doesn't matter whether it results ultimately in full-blown intercourse or not. That doesn't make any difference. It still means the same thing either way.
I have two thoughts that come up when you say this. One is, It can come to mean very little, Jack, because we callous ourselves to the understanding of what it is in our lives. We
That's
become
true.
So familiar with it. It becomes so much just a part of our everyday life that we really lose our sensitivity to our own consciousness of what our sexuality means. But I'd like to tell you a story. The second thing I was thinking about in my own life, actually I don't really want to tell you this story, but I think that it might be helpful and instructive here. When I was a young woman, I had a relationship with a man for about a year that I really liked this man and really wanted to have a long-term relationship with him. In our relationship, we weren't very sexual. I don't think we were doing what was right in my understanding of sexuality now. We were being sexual, but in ways that I didn't define as wrong. We were kissing, we were holding hands, in erotic ways. We were being erotic with each other in various different ways. We weren't having intercourse, nor were we fondling each other. At one point in the relationship, about a year down the line, I saw him starting to move away from me, noticing in his actions and his attitude that he just really wasn't as interested in me as he had been. One of the ways that I had tried to be interesting to him in the past was to not be very sexual with him, because I knew that was a value that he had. But as we were going along in our relationship and it was breaking down some, I realized that a way that I could, kind of on a covert level, draw him to me was to be more sexual. And I remember at one specific time, I still remember the evening, when I did something sexual that was probably inappropriate to say on the radio, but did something that wasn't intercourse, but I knew was way beyond the bounds of where we had gone before. And because it was, to me, kind of an effort to keep him with me. And at that time, he was very interested in it. He went along with it. We were involved in the sexual play together. But it was very soon after that he walked away from me and our relationship ended. It didn't end with us talking about what had happened, either in that situation or generally in the relationship. But even as I think about it now, I have kind of a numbness going through my body, because I have this sense that I did something that was wrong for me and it was wrong for him. I felt like I betrayed myself and I felt like I betrayed him. And it goes beyond feeling. I did betray me and I did betray him. I tried to get something that wasn't mine dishonestly.
I think that's a very important point, that so many people intuitively use sexuality to try to obligate the other person to themselves, to try to capture them somehow. And there's a certain amount of sense there's a certain amount of logic to that. And that is because I think instinctively and intuitively we know that being intimate with someone is making a promise to them and them committing to me, that they are promising something to me. To allow myself to be known, to allow myself to be intimately known, my body to be intimately known, is to promise my very self to the other person. And so instinctively we feel like if we can involve them more sexually, then we are making them more committed to ourselves.
We can kind of deepen the relationship. We can kind of get them to be more glued to me.
Yes.
And oftentimes it really works in a sense that the other person really is drawn to me. But they're not being drawn to my heart and my soul. They're being drawn to my body. And in that situation, I was using my body. I was using myself. And that's how I was betraying myself. And I was asking him to do the same.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting a closer, deeper involvement in an appropriately good and right way in our relationship. It was wrong.
And most importantly, it doesn't lead to a decision to make a moral commitment to another human being on a matter of principle. It doesn't lead me to face into the question, am I willing to commit myself to this man or this woman for the rest of my life to do right by them before God? That's not the question that it's leading to. And that's why it's so ultimately destructive, because that's the question that we ultimately have to face when we're facing into the question, am I going to get married to someone? Am I going to say yes and make vows to them for the rest of my life? If we put sex first, then we're creating an illusion of commitment. And if we get married out of that illusion, then we are simply getting married on the basis of an illusion. What God, I think, would have us do, what the biblical ethic would have us do, is to determine, do I want to be committed to that person? That human being over there, do I want to get to know them as another creature made by God in His image who's unique? And do I want to spend the rest of my life getting to know them? And then, having made that commitment, find it appropriate to express that that unique loyalty through sexuality. That's how God would have it. But to use sexuality to try to manufacture that relationship will almost always backfire. And if it doesn't backfire, it's only accidental that it doesn't.
Yeah, sexuality, as I've come to see it, Jack, is something that expresses my emotional commitment to my husband. It isn't what came first. It's what follows, an emotional commitment to him as a person, and really to myself as a person, and our relationship together, and the deepening of our relationship. In the deepening of our relationship, out of it comes our sexual relationship that becomes more and more meaningful to us.
Yeah.
And I was trying to do it in the opposite way with this young man. I wanted to have a relationship with him, and I was going to base it on sexuality. I was going to base it on whatever I could so that I would just keep him. And it was all turned around, and it was shallow, and I'm saddened by it even as I think about it today.
Yeah. There was another book I read.
You read a lot of books.
Back in the 60s.
I read a lot of books in the 60s.
I did. I was trying to figure this stuff out. It was a very well-meaning book, and I suppose perhaps even taken in the way that he intended it, I think maybe it might have even been right, the way I interpreted it, I think ended up being very misleading and very unfortunate in my own life. He was asking the question, he was exploring the question in this book, what's an appropriate level of physical involvement between a man and a woman? And he likened the relationship between a man and a woman to a three-legged stool, where one leg is the physical, one leg is the emotional, and one leg is the spiritual. And that as a man and woman move toward oneness with respect to their emotional commitment and their spiritual oneness, and I must confess I'm not altogether clear what the difference between the spiritual and emotional was. I think probably he was thinking in terms of the religious and the pious, that in your religious life and your life of piety, somehow growing together. I must confess I don't exactly know what that means, but as you grow closer to one another emotionally and spiritually, then it would be appropriate, just like in the legs of a stool, to be correspondingly closer physically. I don't know without drawing the picture if I'm clear, but a three-legged stool, the legs are sloped upward, meeting at the top, or coming close to meeting at the top.
And so, there's a stability when you have all three.
Exactly. The idea is, in order to keep the relationship stable, they need to proceed toward the top of the stool at the same rate together. And by implication, by the analogy, and that's exactly the point, by analogy, there would be something inappropriate, unstable, unbalanced, if the physical were lagging behind. So that if you're growing together spiritually and emotionally, but we're not correspondingly being more intimate physically, that there would be something unstable and unhealthy and imbalanced about that relationship.
Well, certainly in a marriage, that's true.
Everything exactly.
Grows together at the same time, or that's a really wonderful part of a good marriage.
Right. The question becomes, if you have a man and woman, a young man and woman, and Christians who are engaged to one another, and they were to look at that image, what exactly would that translate into? Would, in their engagement, they are committed, they're as committed emotionally as you can get, they're just waiting for the wedding to formalize it and make it official and make it actual, and so presumably spiritually as well, they are growing together. Does that mean that in the context of engagement, there ought to be pretty significant sexual intimacy going on? That there should be this kind of responsible petting that this other guy was talking about, or some fairly significant sexual foreplay that goes on because, after all, they are committed emotionally and spiritually. Well, I think that's very... My answer to that is no, it doesn't mean that at all. That in the context of engagement, we would do well to, again, reserve that sexual intimacy for marriage. It's not appropriate in the context of engagement. It's only appropriate in the context of marriage. So it seems to me that image that he presented there is very misleading and is ultimately very... is ultimately destructive. It leads to a lot of unnecessary tension and guilt and struggle in a relationship that people otherwise would be fortified against if they could just decide, no, as a matter of principle, sex belongs in marriage, not in engagement.
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
So Jack, in the 60s, you were reading a lot of books, trying to figure out, what is your sexuality? What does it mean? What do I do with it? And one of the books you read said that when people are in a relationship outside of marriage, before marriage, they need to be developing a spiritual, emotional, and physical relationship and having those all in balance with each other. You were saying that that's wrong, though. Before marriage, we need not to have a physically intimate relationship with one another, even when we're engaged. Why? Because when we're engaged, we're saying, I'm making a commitment to you, and that's what sex is saying. I'm making a commitment to you.
Yeah, so why should that be inappropriate?
Right. Yeah.
In my view, what the Bible is teaching us is that sexual intimacy is saying what has already been said. I mean, it's ratifying a promise that's already been made and followed through with. It's in the security of the commitment already having been cemented and made a historical reality in my life. It's in the security of that relationship that the vulnerability of sexual intimacy is appropriate. Outside the context of that reality, if the commitment has only been promised, I promised that I will make the commitment, but I have not actually made the commitment. Outside of that context, then sexuality remains a lie. Now, granted, it's less of a lie if I really am emotionally committed and I really do intend to follow through on it. Granted that it's not the same degree of falsehood that casual sex is. I grant that. But in terms of the moral appropriateness of it, I still think that sexual intimacy is only morally appropriate in the context of the marriage relationship itself. But I do want to qualify that in an important way. It may very well be that book describing this relationship like a three-legged stool was trying to say something like this, and I would agree with this. The problem with growing together toward a marriage that God is putting together and making inevitable, the problem that we face is, as I was getting to know my wife, I had early on a sense that I was going to marry this woman one day. It was inevitable. I really sensed that this was going to happen. But it took time for me emotionally to catch up to the inevitability of that. But was I ready to do it? Did I want to do it? Was it right to do it? Was it wise to do it? Would I be foolish to be doing this? This is scary. Am I ready to take on this scary kind of commitment that I'm faced into? It takes time to process all that emotionally and to resolve that into an act of commitment. And part of the information that I need for me to resolve it emotionally is she interested? Does she want to marry me? Not many men who want to go ask a woman to marry them when they're pretty sure she's going to say no, because the rejection that they feel and the rebuff that they feel from in a situation like that is painful, and we don't do that gladly and willingly. So we try to get some kind of we try to gauge where do I stand with that woman? Is she interested in me or not? Well, how do we know that the other person is interested? We look at the kind of time they're willing to spend with me. We look at the kind of things they say to me. We look at the ways they treat me. Do they treat me with respect? Do they seem to value me and appreciate me as a person? We're trying to read all of those things. One of the things I think that we do ultimately read are the shows of physical affection. A touch here, a look here, and so on. I do not believe that it is inappropriate when the end result is this marriage that is inevitably going to happen. Things that in any other relationship would be sexually inappropriate, I think are an inevitable part of the process of growing toward marriage in a relationship that ends in marriage. The holding hands, a kiss here, and so on. You know, I'm making an absolute statement that those are ultimately erotic and they have no place outside of marriage. Here I want to qualify that, though. The early stages of erotic, affectionate, physical behavior seems to me we're kind of going to bumble our way into them in the course of making a lifelong commitment to one another. We're just going to find ourselves kissing them or touching their hand or giving them a look or something like that. I think the end result vindicates that as having been morally appropriate. But we can't take that casually. I mean, in the end, it's going to be vindicated only because it was the result of a heart that was being drawn to make a commitment. And we can only know that in retrospect. We can't know that at the time.
We're really turning a corner here because you and I both said, is any kind of sexual intimacy wrong outside of marriage? And we said, absolutely, it's right. Wrong outside of marriage. But in a sense, we're saying that engagement or a very strong belief that this is the person we're going to marry is going into a new category.
It's a transition point.
It's a transition into a commitment. Now, I can use that as an excuse.
You can. That's right.
I can say, well, I really thought I was going to be committed to this person, but... And so what we're looking at is really having to be honest with ourselves here. Is this truly somebody that I am going to be committed to in a marriage relationship, or am I just playing with it? Am I just using this? Is it an excuse? And certainly a billion people could use it as an excuse, and anybody listening here could. But again, it comes down to our heart.
Yeah.
And my heart before God. God isn't fooled. He's not. I remember one time somebody coming and telling me how much they loved me and cared about me, and yet everything in their actions was saying, "I don't care about you, and you're not important to me." But what they said to me at that point was, "Let's pray. Let's just pray to God about this." And this person started to pray about their loving me and their commitment to me, and I couldn't even bow my head. I just couldn't even pray. And I finally just looked up and said, "Hey, Joe," that's not his name, "God isn't fooled by this. You don't love me. You're not loving me. And it doesn't matter if we pray or not. It isn't happening." And it was a very difficult time for us because he really wanted me to believe that, and he wanted to believe in himself, but it just wasn't true. And eventually, he admitted to it. But again, we can just really fool ourselves and say what really isn't true. On the other hand, I like the corner that you turned, because when I really am committed to another person in my heart, when I really do know I'm going to marry them, when I am, in a sense, engaged to them in my heart, there is an appropriateness of expression that is emotional and that is physical. There's very different things that I say in my relationship to someone I'm going to marry than to someone I don't think I'm going to marry. There's a lot that's just new, that's unique to us now.
Right. And someone may argue, what was your problem earlier with an engagement, talking about sexual foreplay and engagement, if you're talking about somehow the physical being appropriate here? Here's where I draw the line. The question is, what purpose does it serve? What's happening here? A touch, a glance, a kiss, an embrace can communicate something important and meaningful to the relationship. Namely, if you ask me, I will say yes. I mean, I think it's one of the ways in which we communicate to the other person, I am prepared to make a commitment if you are. And therefore, it's a way that we find ourselves to that commitment that God is drawing us toward. And because we eventually make the commitment, the rightness of me communicating to that other person is vindicated. Sexual foreplay is not necessary to that. I don't need to be involved in passionate sexual foreplay to communicate I'm ready to and willing to make this commitment. It's the gentler erotic stuff that is quite sufficient to make that, to communicate that message. And that's what needs to be communicated. That's appropriate to the level of the relationship. The other is not. The reason I engage in sexual foreplay is because I want physical gratification. It's not for the relationship that I'm doing that. It's for my own selfishness.
And I really think that's the distinction. In the physical relating that we're talking about in engagement or pre-engagement, we're saying to the other person, I value you, you're important to me. Do you want to be in a lifelong relationship with me? I want to do that with you. And we're pretty sure that the other person does by that time anyway, especially if the physical actions are reciprocated equally. But it isn't about sexual gratification. And that's the line that you're drawing.
Right, exactly.
And I like that distinction. I've never really thought about it that way, but I think that's a really, really helpful thing. I'm not taking from you, I'm giving to the relationship.
Yeah.
And you know, we can abuse that one also.
Yeah, that's the key. Anything, any place we draw the line, any rationale we give, any theory that we expound is always going to be subject to abuse by our rationalizing our behavior. At the bottom line, I think it's something you said in our last program together, at the bottom line is always, what is my heart? What's happening there? Am I given over to integrity here? Do I want what God wants? Do I want sexual purity? Do I want my sexuality to be used in a way that is appropriate to God's design for it? Or am I just getting selfish here? Am I just going after what I want here? And in the final analysis, it's where it's rooted in the heart that determines what's moral and what's immoral, not how I define it in terms of outward, what it looks like outwardly, but where it's rooted in the heart. That's the key issue.
I like what you said about, am I given over to? And when we're thinking about where do we draw the line sexually, if I ask myself the question, in this act, am I given over to integrity? In this act, am I given over to love? In this act, am I given over to pursuing who God is in my life? If I can answer yes to those questions, and honestly, yes.
Yeah, and that's the key.
then yes. If I'm honest and I say no, then I need to back off. And it's a hard backing off. It's a difficult one. We're not talking about something that's easy here. We're not taking it lightly. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
All of us, like you said, I think in the beginning of this program, are very interested in our sexuality, are very interested in sexual pleasure. It's a really good gift. It's something that it's really hard to abstain from before we're married. It's hard to abstain from for some married people to be with other people. It's hard not to be with many people. But we just have to work at it. It's a labor.
Right. And it comes back to that particular issue comes back to what we were talking about in prior shows about the purpose of sexuality. As much as pleasure can be a part of sexuality, it is not its purpose. And we have to understand that. The godly person, the righteous person, is willing to take pleasure from God as a gift from God serendipitously, you know, as something that God just sends my way as he wills. But it's our sinfulness, our rebellion against God, that sees the possibility of pleasure out there and says, I don't want to miss it. I don't want to just take it as it comes. I don't want to just take it as God gives it to me in the right context, when it's appropriate, when it's within the bounds of morality. I want it because I want it. I want it because it's pleasurable. I want it because it feels good. And that's all that matters to me.
And the feel like it from you is, I'm just going to take it.
I'm just going to take it.
I want it, and I want it now, and I'm going to get it.
Yeah. It's that selfishness. It's that defiance of God's purposes and God's will and God's desire that is at the root of the evil behind the kind of hedonism that characterizes our culture. That we go for pleasure because it's pleasure. It doesn't make any difference to us, the rightness or wrongness of it. That's not even a category we're thinking in terms of. You know, I think I've mentioned the lyrics of these songs before, but how can something that feels so good be so wrong? That's the mantra of our culture. If it feels good, then don't tell me no. If it feels good, if it feels wonderful, if it feels noble, if it feels beautiful, then don't cramp my style. Don't put these artificial boundaries on me and make me dance to your tune. Well, but if the tune is being played by God, what else is a godly person supposed to do except allow ourselves to dance to his tune? If God says, this is what sexuality is for, this is how I designed it, this is the purpose it's supposed to play, this is the function it's supposed to have in your life, if I'm a godly person, I will say, really? Okay, then let me do that. Let me make that be what my sexuality is to me, and let me not rebel against it and decide, no, my sexuality is for pleasure. That's what mine's for. That kind of hostility and rebellion is just wrong.
That might mean I might be deprived of something that I really want in my life.
You will be.
Yeah.
You really will want it.
Yeah, I really, really will want it. It's not just the sexual pleasure, but it's the intimacy that I feel when I'm really closely connected in a physical way to another person. And I think we intuitively know that's true, that it not only feels good, but it's, I have this sense of connectedness that I can't really have in any other way.
And
not to have that my whole life is such a huge, it's a daunting task. It's a daunting labor that a single person has to face probably every single day of their life.
Right.
And I'm not really one to speak about that. I got married when I was 24, and I've had a sexually active life ever since then. So I can't speak about the deprivation, and people can say, well, you don't know what you're talking about, Christine. And they're right. I really don't know what I'm talking about in this respect. And there are many things in my life that I must be deprived of. And I think there are many things that are different than sexuality, but is as alluring to us as sexuality that we have to live deprived of in our lives. All of us do.
Yeah. Although Christine, I think that single people can get the mistake of thinking that married people know nothing about what they're going through. And that's not true, because you soon find out in marriage that not in marriage either, neither as a single person and not in marriage, do I just get sex whenever I want it. Whenever the pressure is there, whenever the desire is there, whenever the longing is there, whenever the passion might be burning within, you married people have it easy. You can just have sex with your wife or husband. Well, that's not true. Even married people know that love needs to control the fulfillment of their sexual gratification. And there come times when one might be burning with desire and have to control themselves, you know, have to say, but this is not a good time for my wife or my husband. And it's really fundamentally the same thing. They may not have to exercise that self-control as often and all the time, but it's not like they don't need to learn that self-control, and it's not like they have never experienced it. They mm-hmm. they know what that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am corrected. You're absolutely right. I think that it's probably, though, more true for men, because men tend to have a stronger sexual urge than a woman does, and they have to control more because of that. There are times when I have to in my marriage, but I think for my husband it's far more frequent. When I really want to be sexual in my husband, and I can't be for whatever reason, or aren't being for whatever reason, it's very, very difficult for me. I don't like it. I'm glad that there's going to be an end to it. It's hard for me to not be able to gratify it. But for a single person, they have to encounter that all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. And what I would say to a single person is, don't go down the road. Really, you know, put some real boundaries on how far you go in your mind and with your body. I think that, for example, masturbation can be a really very, very hurtful thing for a single person. For other reasons, but for this reason certainly, is I'm training my body to be sexually aroused, and when I get into situations with a man or a woman, that's I'm just going to have that on my mind, and I'm making it so much more difficult for myself.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of myth, and I'm not even sure where it comes from. It may even just come from my own experience that passion, when passion comes on strong, passion is always going to win. That the more I resist it, the stronger it's going to get. And the more I resist it, the stronger it's going to get. I'm going to eventually succumb to the temptation for self-gratification. So I might as well give in now, because it's not going to go away.
It's inevitable.
And yet, human experience, I think, actually teaches us the opposite. If I exercise self-control, eventually it saps the passion of its power and its strength. If I can resist it and say no to it long enough, eventually it resolves itself into a manageable, you know, a manageable longing in the background, and not this insatiable craving that is going to overpower me. Mm-hmm. And yet we experience it so often when we really feel the sexual pressure and the urge to gratify myself, we feel like it's just no use. It's just so strong. I'm no match for it. And we have to learn that the opposite is the case. I can manage. I can control myself. I can control my passions. I just need to know why it's right to do it. I need to know why and act on principle and say no to it and keep saying no to it, and the torture will eventually end. Even though there are moments and times where it feels like torture, but the torture does end.
I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. What does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following, the students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. Throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated, sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you're interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College.
Fundamentally, what we are talking about today is how to understand the role of and the place for sexual intimacy outside of marriage. And that's easy to answer in the context of casual relationships between men and women. Sexual intimacy has absolutely no role to play at all. Where it becomes difficult is when two people are being drawn together toward a marriage commitment that they are eventually going to make to one another. Is there any place, any role for sexual intimacy in the context of that growing relationship toward commitment? And what I was trying to suggest is, fundamentally, the answer is no, if what we mean by that is actual sexual intimacy in the form of sexual foreplay of one kind or another, then I think the answer is still no. Right up until the day that I have said my vows to the woman, it really never is appropriate to engage in sexual foreplay. Having said that, I also said that there are the quieter, gentler, milder forms of erotic behavior that would be inappropriate in any other relationship that I do think become a part of the language in the relationship whereby they do become appropriate, and the appropriateness of them ultimately becomes vindicated by the marriage that grows out of them. A kiss, an embrace, a touch, a look can communicate to the other person, I've made up my mind. I know where I want this relationship to go. If you're willing to commit your life to me, I'm willing to commit my life to you. And I think the physical, certain mild physical affection in the context of that growing relationship can be a way in which to help one another find their way to making that commitment, and therefore is appropriate. But beyond that, but that's the line where it crosses the boundary from the language of I'm ready to commit my life to you to I really am experiencing physical desire for sexual gratification. I want sexual gratification, and that becomes the motive. That's completely inappropriate outside the context of marriage.
And what I kept saying in our discussion was, okay, we can draw a line, and then we can use it inappropriately. We can always abuse it. I could say, well, I really thought I was going to get married to this person, and it's true. I could really think I am and then not. That certainly can happen. But what we're talking about is kind of a degree of certainty that I'm going to be moving toward marriage, and then in that movement toward marriage, I'm starting to communicate with all of me that I'm committed to you, that I love you, that you're important to me, that you're special to me. You know, Jack, that always can be abused, except God always knows our hearts, and we need to be given over to God. To love, to commitment, to Him. What's that look like from person to person? That's hard to say. I don't know your heart. God knows our hearts, though.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 1-800-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.